Good evening. My name is Sotan. I'm one of the senior students here. And there are a couple of things that fell into my email queue. The last few days have been really weird at work, so I've sort of lost track of time. It could have been 36 hours ago, or maybe it was 24 hours ago, but it was a short time ago. And one followed the other. The first was a letter from Eugen, who has been selected, one of our students here, who's been selected by Roshi to be the head student for the summer ongo, the summer intensive meditation period, which is a pretty big deal. She's going to sort of model Zen practice for the community, for the month up there on retreat at the Grail, and for those of us who are practicing down here in the city during that time. And it's customary during Ongo that a text is selected for us all to focus on, whether we're sitting there or here, to study together. And sometimes it's very ancient Buddhist text, sometimes it's a little bit more modern. What her email was about, in part, was encouraging us to make a commitment during the Ongo this summer to whatever our practice is, to sort of up the ante a bit, and to tell us what the selected text is and make that available. And if you go online at the Village Zendo website and follow the links, you'll find where you can download this year's text, as well as her Shuso letter. That's what being the head student for Ongo is called. You become the Shuso. And at some point, I would recommend taking a look at those. But I opened up the text, and it's a little early to start studying it, but I wanted to get a sense of where we were headed. And the first, what she wrote is, the study text for this summer's Ongo will be Dogen's Fascicle 64, Everyday Activity. So Dogen is the great Japanese Zen master, philosopher, who brought Zen from Japan, to Japan from China about 800 years ago. And many of his texts, they seem very obscure when you start to read them, though often there's a captivating poetry about them that maybe helps you get past how obscure they are. This one actually is not as obscure as many, which is not to say that it's not obscure. And it's a few pages, it's not a very long text, but I just took a glimpse. I was sort of curious to get a taste of what it would be. And I'll give you the first couple of sentences, which sort of, as often happens with Dogen, the first couple of sentences really tell you the whole thing, and the rest is sort of elaboration. He writes, in the domain of Buddha ancestors, drinking tea and eating rice are everyday activity. Drinking tea and eating rice have been transmitted for a long time and are present right now. Thus, the Buddha ancestors' vital activity of drinking tea and eating rice comes to us. And as she says in her letter, this text speaks directly to the exhilarating right here and now of practice. Zen speak. What we sort of mean by that, I'm not going to do a deep dive into Dogen now. I'm not sure I'm ever capable of doing that. But you already sort of, I guess, since you're all sitting here in a Zendo, you have a sense of what he's pointing at. And one way to state that might be how the ordinary, drinking water, eating a bowl of rice, sitting in a community quietly, the ordinary stuff is actually quite extraordinary. And what is transmitted by our Buddha ancestors is the awareness that stuff that is very ordinary is the stuff that is truly extraordinary. That when you wake up to the ordinary, that's the thing itself. It's not something over there, it's not something you're trying to get, It's not some amazing special bliss state. It's just, this is a really good drink of water. Thank you, Jisha. So a lot of our practice, I think, and a lot of the way we talk about our practice turns on that kind of thing, that what we're looking for out there is actually right here, right now, and it's very ordinary. There's nothing special about it. And yet, if you can realize that, it's absolutely extraordinary. At the same time, not separately, not differently, at the very same time, it is absolutely the most mundane thing in the world. You might get a sense of this if you've had a really good deep sit, and somewhere in the course of the Zazen period, you look up and maybe you see a little bit of dust going by in the air in front of you and the light hits it. And there's just something remarkable about that. And, I mean, there are dust motes going by you all the time and you never notice it. But that one time, all of a sudden, or you're on retreat and you've had a horrible morning. Your knees are killing you, your back's aching, you didn't sleep all night, you've got four more days of this hell going on, and you think you're not getting anywhere in your practice, and then you go to breakfast, and you take a bite of oatmeal or toast, and it's the most amazing thing ever, you know? A very vivid version of this happened to me. I don't know, it was like 8 or 9 years ago. I had a very, very bad week. Some of you know about this. I got misdiagnosed with terminal cancer for 5 days. That was a very rich sort of experience, you know. That was hardly ordinary. It was very extraordinary. And Sybil Myoshin Taylor, who, because I'm old and my back is stiff, she's up there somewhere. Oh, there she is. Second row up from the bottom, third person in. She had terminal cancer 4 times in her life, starting in her late 20s, and she finally died of one of them in her early 70s. Remarkably. The whole thing was remarkable. Her whole life was remarkable. So who are you going to call if you get diagnosed with terminal cancer? I'm calling Myoshin. And we had this wonderful talk. This was day 2 of the nightmare on 23rd Street in a diner. And talking to her, she was our first of what Roshi calls our bodhisattva elders, which is a special designation for lay practitioners who are not, have no desire to become an official teacher, but clearly have attained some sort of understanding and wisdom. And Sib was, no question, deserving of that. And just sitting with her, without talking about much, just everything sort of settled down. And I remember coming out of the restaurant, and there was this tulip growing in, you know, one of those little dry, horrible spots around a desiccated tree on 23rd Street. And it was just the most beautiful tulip, and it was just like, you know, the ordinary had become extraordinary, in part now because I thought I had 6 months to live. And that forced everything to become that amazing. So there are ways we experience it, sometimes through practice, sometimes just the circumstance of our lives, and suddenly something that's just plain and everyday takes on this added something. It hasn't changed, but how we experience it has. But that's not actually the topic of my talk. What I wanted to talk about is sort of the reverse of this, and this is email number 2. Email number 2, which I opened up actually just before I opened up Eugene's, was from Kaku, one of our Hoshis. So, you know, Hoshi then becomes Sensei, then becomes Roshi one day, theoretically, if there's a path and a hierarchy, blah, blah, blah. So he's up there. And he's a dear friend of mine. We've known each other for years. And he was supposed to give the Dharma talk tonight. And he sent me an email, "Soten, any chance you could pinch hit for me for the Dharma talk tomorrow night?" And he's out of town, and he can't get back in time, and he's hoping I will rescue him from the situation so he doesn't have to worry about it. And so I wrote back, "Oi, I'm going to say yes. I feel so far from Zen speak these days, but so feel like I should just dive in. And he responds, diving in is Zen! 3! Smiley face, gosho hands. It's like, I didn't need the emojis, thank you. So this is the opposite. I was going to have an ordinary evening tonight, probably working at my office. I've been up, the first talk I gave today for a liver pathology thing was at 7 o'clock this morning, and I had to prepare that last night, and today was going to be all about the follow-up to that and then catching up with my clinical work. I'm a doctor in a hospital. And now suddenly I'm giving a Dharma talk. I can do a liver pathology talk, give me 2 minutes notice, and I'll give an hour talk, no problem. Tell me to give a Dharma talk, and I'm going to be like, oh, really? And what the hell am I going to talk about? And I haven't been to the Zendo and heard anyone else's Dharma talk in how long, and how do I find... And then I open up Eugen's thing, and it's like, oh, well, at least I've got Dogen in front of me. Okay, let's pick something. But I realized that part of the feeling I had with this is the sudden horrible feeling in my stomach that the day I had plotted for myself had suddenly gone completely awry, and my cortisol levels are up, my anxiety's up, my adrenaline's up, I'm having a hard time sleeping because what am I going to talk about at the Zendo? I got to face people, half of whom don't even know who I am, so it's going to be really humiliating. I don't mind humiliating myself in front of people who know me, but strangers, that's a whole other thing. And I thought, oh, well, actually, this isn't a bad topic. It's certainly what I was feeling like sitting here. I don't know what I looked like sitting here, but I was not really focusing on my breath. And I was focusing on, why did I put this? Is this the cushion I'm going to sit on during my Dharma talk? And did I remember to put that thing in the thing I was going to, you know? Will I remember to rearrange the things in the Dharma talk that I typed out before and I realized they're backwards? You know, blah, blah, blah. Crisis mode. Which, stating it more broadly, I mean, this is a pathetic little example of something that I think's really bigger, which is one of the other aspects of Zen practice is how the extraordinary becomes ordinary. That the moment of crisis, which seems like it's blasted you out of your existence and suddenly everything becomes heightened because you're anxious or afraid or angry or something, with steady Zen practice, that stuff sort of doesn't faze you as much. And that stuff just sort of becomes no different than the ordinary stuff, theoretically. And so that's actually what I wanted to sort of explore. We sort of are used to the idea, we come in here and hear a lot about if we simply sit, Dogen said, Zazen is manifesting your Buddha nature. This is enlightenment right here, just sitting the way we have been doing, the way you're doing now, theoretically listening to me. I wouldn't say that what I'm doing, gesticulating with my hand, is the same, but okay. That is Buddha nature right there. And that's one of those perfectly simple but incredibly difficult things that Dogen says that we sort of have to wrap our heads around. But we don't have to wrap our heads around it because if we just keep sitting, bit by bit, somehow we start to get that. We don't actually have to strive after it. We don't have to think about it. We certainly don't have to talk about it. All we have to do is sit. And in the same way, a whole bunch of things unfurl when we practice on a regular basis. Daily, weekly, monthly, year after year. And you sort of don't have to worry about these things happening. And lots of claims for contemplative practice from all sorts of different traditions, including Zen, the wider practices of the different forms of Buddhism, and then wider practices out of there. And people have been skeptical about a lot of these things. But over time, we've come to realize, and one of the things I've been involved in and have written about and read a lot about, and done some research with, is how contemplative practices actually do affect the changes in the lives of people like us if we simply practice. What are the kinds of things that happen? Well, the simplest thing is you change the way your mind works. You become better able to concentrate. Your senses, the acuity of your senses goes up. We can actually measure this. Vision gets better and more precise. Hearing gets better. And you may notice it after you've been sitting for a period that you are hearing things on the street or in the room more distinctly. But that's something that actually happens continually over time and builds and accumulates over time. There are Tibetan Buddhist practitioners who meditate on seeing in a dark room a single spark 30 feet away. Now, our eyes probably can't see that spark. But you can actually, there's research to suggest that a meditator can actually see a single photon of light. And, you know, we could talk about that for a while. So that sort of stuff happens. It's real. Other stuff that happens is our health improves. Blood pressure diminishes. Ulcers go away. Scars. You get wound healing with less scarring and healing happens quicker. All of these things actually happen. This is real. Some of the other stuff that's claimed is psi phenomenon, so like precognition and clairvoyance. And it turns out that everybody has some tiny degree of this that can be tested and measured. And if you meditate, it increases. And if you meditate a lot, it increases a lot. And this has been measured and studied, and you know that actually happens. But that's the kind of stuff that brings some people to practice. But in Zen, what we're really aiming at is something more important, more fundamental, which is to get some insight into the nature of existence itself. And with that comes the awareness of how special something as ordinary as a drink of water is, but also how things that seem extraordinary, in fact, aren't. They're just sort of another ripple in the ocean of your awareness. And nothing to get particularly excited about. Whether it's giving a Dharma talk unexpectedly, or whether you're on the subway and the train and they announce the train's going to be taken out of service. That's really good for a New Yorker's day. Yesterday I was in a hurry to fit in a little bit of exercise at the gym between my horrible work schedule, but I was hungry, so I stopped off at a store, and I got to the gym 5 blocks after the store and realized I had left my wallet at the store. I'd say 10 years ago that would have completely freaked me out. Now it was just like, okay, walk back to the store. And I really think that isn't because I've consciously become a healthier person by trying. I think it's because of my Zen practice. Above that, I would put finding out you're going to give a Dharma talk unexpectedly 24 hours away. Someone having a heart attack on the plane you're on and you're the doctor even though you're a pathologist. That's fun. That never bothered me as much as these other things because I went through medical school. And one of the things you're taught in medical school, beaten over the head over and over again, is how to set aside that anxiety, get confident in that you have something inside you that will answer to what's needed, and stay calm through that so you can present that. So that was 4 years of medical school and several years of internship residency building that kind of thing up. So in that kind of situation, I'm really good. But, you know, the subway getting taken out of service, not so much necessarily. If you were in New York City when 9/11 hit, how do you stay stable and calm through something that extraordinary? I'm certainly not at a point where I could deal with that, and I certainly wasn't then. What about when you're told you have 6 months to live? It's not happening to someone else, it's happening to you. And one of the things that was interesting that week was all the things I can fall back on to distract myself routinely or have in my life, movies, show tunes, Valium, marijuana, and believe me, I tried all of those at one point in that week or another. The only thing that allowed me to stay calm was sitting and focusing on right now, right here. And right now and right here, all of a sudden, this horrible situation was completely ordinary. Because right here, right now, I'm just on my cushion and I'm breathing. I'm not worrying about what happened, and I'm not worrying about what's coming either. I'm so focused on right now that that's enough. And everything just became really simple, as long as I could do that. So I think Zen practice actually prepares you for all of these kind of moments when your mundane, daily expected life that's really ordinary suddenly erupts into something you don't expect. How do you respond to that? There's a famous case study, and I believe it's been repeated. I didn't have time today to go look to see if there was a bigger study of many people, but I think it's been done. But the case study that's at the heart of this was like 15 years ago, I think. Some of you may have heard of a Tibetan Buddhist monk named Matthieu Ricard. He's a French guy, was a physicist, and then became a Tibetan Buddhist monk. He's very big in the Mind and Life Organization, which is that group of cognitive and neuroscientists that talk with the Dalai Lama a lot. And they studied him doing open present awareness, what we in our practice call shikantaza, and then made noises to see how he responded to those noises. And it turned out that a sudden noise as loud as a gunshot right by his ear, barely a twitch of his face muscles. They tried him not meditating, and he jumped like anybody else would. But during his meditation, something that loud and sudden, he heard it. It's not that he wasn't listening, but it just didn't faze him. It was just a ripple in his awareness. It was nothing more than that. And I think that's partly what our practice does for us, and that we can trust in our practice to do this for us if we just do the practice. It takes care of us without us having to do it, without us having to lift a finger. You know, you can say it's like water wearing down a rock or a mountain of snow, one snowflake at a time. It's really slow, and it's really subtle. But if you sit every day, day after day, week after week, month after month, I'm sure the people in this room who have spent years sitting by this time know that they're not quite sure how it happened, but they're not the people they were, and probably they're not the people they would have been if they hadn't been sitting. And for me personally, part of it is there's a diminished reactivity to this kind of stuff. 10 years ago, I would have said no to an invitation to give a Dharma talk all of a sudden. And even if I said yes, because I probably would have, because I'd feel guilty, nice Jewish boy thing, I would have really suffered today, really suffered. And instead, I sort of went through my day thinking, there's going to be half an hour at some point today where I can think about this. And there was, and here I am. I think that's because of my practice. I don't think it's because of something I learned elsewhere. I don't think it's because of what my mom taught me. I think it's because of what we do on the cushion. So, there are two ways we train for this. One is we just sit and trust in the fact that this will reveal itself. It'll develop over time. The other is to put yourself in situations kind of fearlessly where that's going to be challenged. And just showing up to a zendo is like that. You're going to sit still for 25, 30, or 35 minutes, no matter how much it hurts, no matter how your foot falls asleep, which reminds me, the Jisha requested that I remind people that if you're sitting and something falls asleep or hurts too much, in this zendo, we're very gentle about it. Just put your hands together, make a little bow, and then change position, because right now my knee is killing me. And did you notice when you stumbled, when you were getting up? Remember what your responses were when you saw something happen? Think about how you responded. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Was your reaction to, I didn't see that? Was your reaction to, oh God? Was your reaction to, is something needed? Where on that spectrum, when something like that suddenly happened in front of you, or if someone gets hit by a car in front of you on the street outside, your practice affects how that happens. And if Eugen was here, and she's not, so I don't need to say this, but I sort of wanted to say it. I think there are some Shuso's in the room. I think the thing about Shuso training is it's a horrible weeks to a few months, depending winter or summer, of you don't know what's coming. And every Shuso says, isn't there a manual for what you're supposed to do? And the answer is no. And you just have to go with whatever happens at any moment. And anything happens in a Zen community. And it's crazy making. But by the time you get through, something has changed. Look how calm he is. So I'll finish. I'll finish with two things. One is a little story at the end of the summer's Ango study. It's spelled in our text Zhaozhu. I think this must be Chaozhu, Zhaozhu. Asked a newly arrived monk, have you been here before? And the monk said, yes, I have been here. And Zhaozhu said, have some tea. Later, he asked another monk, have you been here before? The monk said, no, I have not been here. Zhaozhu said, have some tea. The temple director then asked Zhaozhu, why do you say have some tea to someone who has been here and have some tea to someone who has not? Zhaozhu said, director. The director says, yes. Zhaozhu says, have some tea. So I'll close with Agatha. Ordinary becoming extraordinary. Extraordinary becoming ordinary. Have some tea.